Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a look at the findings into what caused the MH17 plane crash. We speak with an analyst about the big debate by Democratic White House hopefuls. We hear about a report on hunger around the world, including in war-besieged Syria.
There are pockets of very severe hunger, particularly in besieged towns and in areas under the control of the Islamic State.
And our music man speaks with us about Demi Lovato's new song. It's right here on The Voice of America. A Dutch-led investigative panel has released details of their findings on the crash of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine in July of 2014, killing all 298 people on board. Our correspondent, Luis Ramirez, is covering this story, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Luis.
Hi, Susan.
What did they say was the cause of this crash?
The primary conclusion of this investigation is that the plane was brought down by a Russian-made Buk missile, or I should say a warhead, from a Buk launcher. That was the main conclusion of this investigation. One of the things that was not clear and that has not been found by this investigation is who launched it. What we did hear from the Dutch safety board, the chairman, said that while it is conclusive that it was a Russian-made surface-to-air missile, there was no light shed on whether it was rebels or Russian forces that actually launched it.
Will there be a criminal investigation to nail this down?
It's too early to say, Susan. At least that is what the Malaysian government is asking for. The Malaysia's prime minister issued a statement shortly after the report was made public, urging strong action be taken against those found responsible. For now, what the Dutch investigation says is that it clearly here, in their opinion, the Ukrainian government knew enough to have restricted airspace for commercial aircraft going in. They said the biggest question they had going into this investigation and throughout the investigation was why a commercial airliner was flying through this zone, even as fighting had been escalating for weeks. They said the officials on the ground had information that the escalation of the fighting could endanger aircraft, including commercial aircraft. Yet there were scores of commercial flights going through that same exact area that day.
Then how did they explain it? Why were all these planes flying over this war zone?
That is one of the mysteries that this investigation, uncovered and is not simply has not resolved. It said that the information was there, yet no one drew a connection between the fighting and the risk to commercial airliners.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Luis, for your insight.
Thank you, Susan.
For a look at what's going on the web concerning this story, we turn to VOA's Sarah Williams. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Susan. Well, as you can imagine, there's been a lot of reaction to the report on the downing of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine. Well, as we just heard, a Dutch-led investigative panel into the crash says the plane was shot down by a surface-to-air missile fired from a Russian-made Buk missile launcher. The chairman of the Dutch Safety Board told family members and the media that the plane was hit on the left side by shrapnel from the detonation of a missile fired from the ground. He said Ukraine was responsible for closing the airspace above the armed conflict zone and chose not to do so. Well, Agence France-Presse reports that Malaysia vowed on Tuesday to seek the prosecution of what it called trigger-happy criminals who downed flight MH17. It also reported that Prime Minister Najib Razak also released a statement vowing that his government would continue to press for justice until those behind this heinous act are made to pay for for their crimes. Meanwhile, Britain's Daily Mirror reports that Russia has accused the Dutch investigation in the MH17 crash of bias, as the firm behind the Buk missile disputed its findings. Russia-based Almaz Antey, the company that makes the missiles, says a different type of Buk was used than that identified by the Dutch. U.S. News and World Report says Tuesday's report was not designed to assign blame to who specifically was responsible for the missile strike, which will be the subject of a subsequent international investigation. Now, the White House has insisted the Russian government and Vladimir Putin had at least indirect involvement in the strike, which it calls a terrible tragedy. Well, now, on a lighter note, the American Music Awards nomination for 2015 have been announced. Luke Bryan, Ariana Grande, Nicki Minaj, Maroon 5, Ed Sheeran, Sam Smith, Taylor Swift, One Direction, Meghan Trainor, and The Weeknd have all been nominated for Artist of the Year. Now, the nominations for Song of the Year include Wiz Khalifa and Charlie Puth with See You Again, Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars, Uptown Funk, Ed Sheeran, Thinking Out Loud, Taylor Swift, Blank Space, and The Weeknd, Can't Feel My Face. The results will be announced in Los Angeles on November 22nd and broadcast on ABC TV. Susan?
Thank you, Sarah, for that report.
Thanks, Susan.
The UN envoy for Libya has announced a proposal for a new unity government for the divided nation in what could be a key step toward ending 4 years of chaos and political turmoil. He said the Libyans must seize this historic opportunity to save Libya. Under the plan, a Tripoli member of the Tobruk parliament, Fayez Sarraj, was named prime minister. He would have three deputies. Six ministers would make up a presidential council. International Edition's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Jackson Pack, president of LibyaAnalysis.com, about the long-awaited proposal and the challenges facing the proposed unity government. Mohamed, how significant is reaching an agreement to form a unity government in Libya?
Well, it sounds like a real breakthrough. However, the various Libyan factions still have to agree to it and work in a good faith to implement it. And according to Jason Pack, there are huge challenges facing the formation of such a government.
Even if the government comes into being, which it may not, it will have no control over the territory of its country. It won't control the capital. It won't even control the parliament buildings. The Islamic State is on the rise in Sirte and in the surrounding area. It's been able to launch attacks on oil infrastructure as far away as almost 200 kilometers from its bases. And, of course, the unity government will provoke various factions to oppose it. And what this means is that you're going to have an embattled government which doesn't control its own offices, has barely any army or militias loyal to it, and it's difficult to see what it can do at all other than call its international backers and ask for military support mission.
Mohamed, many experts say that the most daunting mission will be disarming the Libyan militias in order for the country to restore law and order. So, with what Jason just said, it seems more difficult to handle this issue.
Well, Sue, he said there is no one in particular who can disarm the various entrenched militias in Libya, but he offered his own vision of how to deal with this crucial issue.
The only way to achieve some kind of disarmament is to make a coalition of willing militias. I believe the correct approach is a coalition of militias against the Islamic State, bringing together some moderate Islamic militias, some anti-Islamist militias, and some militias that have very strong revolutionary credentials, but all of whom want to fight the Islamic State. And for me, that is the only possible way to create unity in Libya, as well as to direct the militias towards a more constructive purpose.
Jason Pack noted that the United States and the international community would have to offer forceful sticks and meaningful carrots to motivate compromise among the Libyan factions. He also recommended a peacekeeping force as well as a program to train the Libyan security forces of a sovereign Libyan government.
Thank you, Mohamed, for following the Libyan developments.
Thank you, Sue, for having me.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Did you know that elephants rarely get cancer? Why these giant creatures are better equipped to avoid this dreaded disease has mystified scientists for years. Deepening the mystery further is that elephants have 100 times as many cells as humans, which should also boost the odds of having at least one of those many cells mutate into a cancerous state. Researchers at the Huntsman Cancer Institute and the Ringling Brothers Center for Elephant Conservation say they may have the answer. The scientists found that elephants have 38 additional copies of a modified gene that programs a well-known tumor-suppressing protein called P53. The researchers believe that the elephants may also have a much stronger system for destroying damaged cells that could become cancerous. But further research is needed to confirm this. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Democratic U.S. presidential hopefuls face off today in their first debate. Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, former Virginia Senator Jim Webb, and former Rhode Island Senator Lincoln Chafee will meet in Las Vegas, Nevada. And joining me on the line is political analyst and Professor Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Welcome, Mr. Sabato.
Thank you.
Well, right off the bat, what do you expect to see in this contest?
Hillary Clinton is in the hot seat. It's pretty clear that she's going to be the target of most, maybe almost all, of the attacks. There may be a few stray shots fired by one of the other candidates at Bernie Sanders, for example. But mainly, it's going to be the candidates versus Hillary Clinton because, after all, she has been and still is the front runner. Clinton herself has to be careful. If she makes a single mistake, that will be the headline out of the debate. The other candidates have more leeway. Of course, they have more leeway because several of them are at 1% and 2% in the polls. Bernie Sanders is the other major candidate on stage, and he has refrained from going hard negative or really negative at all against Hillary Clinton. So I think we can expect him to stay relatively substantive.
So far, there's been very little mudslinging by the Democrats, but do you think tonight some of those gloves are going to come off and they'll be getting down and dirty?
For the minor candidates who are lucky enough to be on that stage, meaning Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee and Martin O'Malley, this is their chance. They either have to start moving up or their candidacies are not going to go anywhere. So I would expect that they would take some hard shots at Hillary Clinton and maybe Bernie Sanders. For example, Governor O'Malley, former Governor O'Malley from Maryland, wants to be the main challenger to Hillary Clinton, but he's been kept from doing that because of the success of Bernie Sanders and, of course, because the ghost of Joe Biden looms over that debate stage.
I was going to ask you about that. He's kind of the wild card. Do you think at this late time he might still jump in the contest?
Well, it's possible. I think most people suspect that because this has gone on so long, it's so difficult for him to put an organization together and to raise the many, many millions that would be necessary for him to run, that probably he won't get in. But sometimes we underestimate ambition. He's always wanted to be president. He talked about running for president in the early 1970s when he first got elected to the Senate. He has run twice. Now he's closer than he's ever been. It's his best opportunity. He's doing better in the polls than he ever has been. So the lure is obvious. Now, whether he'll do it, I think we'll know soon. The act is getting old. You know, it's Hamlet on the Potomac. We've seen it before.
I guess I know where you'll be tonight, sitting and watching the debate.
Absolutely. I never miss them. Sometimes I wish I had, but I have to watch.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Coming up on International Edition, a new report on hunger and conflict, and a quick listen to a new Demi Lovato song. The 2015 Global Hunger Index provides a country-by-country snapshot of the food problem in parts of the world. In light of the ongoing refugee crisis from North Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia, this report puts a particular focus on hunger and conflict. Alex Duvall is the executive director of the World Peace Foundation and is in Milan for the launch of the report. Welcome to our program.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. In an overview on a worldwide basis, what were the report's major findings this year?
Well, one of the major findings is that there is enormous progress that's been made towards the goal of eradicating hunger in general and famines in particular, famines being the outbreaks of very severe elevated death due to hunger and starvation. And those are enormously down. And the primary driver of the reduction in famines and generally getting on top of the world hunger problem has been politics, has been the reduction in conflict worldwide and the growth of a more civic, open politics around the world. However, there is a sting in the tail, which is that over the last few years, the indicators have been headed in the wrong direction. And the hunger has been rising, particularly in trouble spots in the Middle East, in parts of Northeast Africa, such as South Sudan and Somalia. And that rise is closely associated with a difficult, horribly complicated, violent conflicts.
There is quite a mess going on right now in Syria, as you know. What was uncovered there in your report?
What that showed is that while we're still some way off having generalized famine conditions in Syria, there are pockets of very severe hunger, particularly in besieged towns and in areas under the control of the Islamic State. And one of the recommendations arising from the report is that not only should humanitarian efforts be scaled up, but more attention should be devoted to resolving conflict in Syria and in providing humanitarian assistance to people across Syria, no matter the political affiliation of the authorities under which they live. So this is a message in part to the U.S. administration. Be a bit more flexible in allowing humanitarian aid to go to areas, to go to civilians who may be under the control of organizations designated as terrorists.
Well, what was found in Iraq and other regions of the Middle East?
The picture across the Middle East is broadly similar. We're really quite concerned about Yemen, although the data for the Global Hunger Index didn't really capture the recent deterioration in the situation in Yemen. Also concerned in various parts of Iraq. And in a few places in Northeast Africa, in some of the countries really on the watch list include South Sudan, include Burundi, include Somalia and Eritrea.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
You're very welcome.
This is VOA.
Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Farm animals are among the world's biggest polluters. Cow dung, for example, contains about 60% methane.
Manure is the ultimate recycling product.
Bill Harkey is with Rosendale Dairy Farm in Wisconsin and says the company is dedicated to sustainability. Rosendale has partnered with a biogas company to turn the manure's methane into electricity.
The majority of our manure goes to the biodigester, and they will take the gases out of it that they can turn into green energy, and then we will get the manure back.
And from that comes another byproduct.
We bring in a lot of recycled products to feed the cows, if you will, and the cows in turn will produce a very nutrient-rich fertilizer.
Rosendale cuts its carbon footprint even further by delivering the fertilizer through a nearly 13-kilometer-long pipeline.
That's helped us reduce the number of truck rolls by about 40,000.
And the cows, well, they seem pretty content with the whole thing. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Hey, my buddy Larry London, the host of Border Crossings, has joined me here in the studio now, and we are going to look at another story from the world of music. And today it's Demi Lovato, singer, actress, many, many talents, and she's got a new album out, I understand. Larry, welcome.
That's right. Thank you, Susan. Yes, her new album is called Confident, and it came out in the middle of October, and the new album is kind of a statement of where she's at right now with her life. She's gone through an awful lot of turmoil in the last couple of years. She was in rehab for a while. She was cutting, I guess they call it cutting, when you hurt yourself.
Yes.
When you're dealing with self-confidence kinds of issues.
Yes, it's very serious.
Crying out for attention. She's gone through those kinds of things. She admitted recently to suffering depression and being bipolar, and she has started her own foundation and mental health awareness campaign because of her own experiences. She wants young people to embrace who they are and love themselves. And so that's kind of one of the things she's doing. With the new album, Confident, she's putting her music behind her message.
It seems so often that some of the great writers and singers, artists have these issues. They have personal issues, and it seems to bring out more of themselves.
Yeah, it's amazing that somebody in show business who's had the attention and success that she's had would be going through these issues and these struggles that, you know, us common folk go through. You wouldn't think that celebrities who have made it. I understand when you're struggling to make it and you haven't made it, it's the climb is very difficult. But she's achieved great things already. She's been in films like Camp Rock. She had her own TV show called Sunny with a Chance. She's going to be in another film. She's going to be a voice character in the film Smurfette.
Oh, that sounds like
another
fun.
Smurf film. And so, you know, she's on tour for the new album, Confident. There have been rumors that she's engaged to actor Wilmer Valderrama. She's been dating him for a number of years. She says, no, we're not engaged. We love each other, but there's no wedding bells in the near future.
Well, tell us about one of these songs on the new album.
Well, the new song that has just come out is the title track, Confident. And it's an upbeat song, and I really like the song a lot. It's the follow-up to what was supposed to be one of the big hits from this past summer called Cool for the Summer. But now the song is Confident, and that is her brand new release, the second release from the fifth album. I used to hold my freak back, now I'm letting go. I make my own choice, yeah, I run this show. So leave the lights on, no, you can't make me behave.
What's wrong with being confident? Uh-huh. Well, you're very good at predicting where everything's going to be on the charts. So where do you think this one's going to land?
Well, I'll tell you what, Susan, that's a great question. Right now, there's a lot of great music coming out. Justin Bieber's new album is coming out soon. So there's a lot of songs out there that are going to make it a tough stretch for her to get to number one, but I would predict she'll be in the top five with this new song.
Okay, you got money on that.
I got some money on it.
Okay,
let's see what I got in my pocket. Not too much.
That's all right. That's where I am, too.
Right.
Okay, thanks, Larry, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the 9th anniversary of the murder of renowned Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. She was shot and killed in the elevator of her apartment building for exposing human rights abuses in Chechnya. In June 2014, a Moscow court convicted five men for the 2006 murder of Ms. Politkovskaya and sentenced them to between 12 and 20 years in prison. Despite these convictions and the 2012 conviction of Dmitry Polyuchenkov for organizing the murder, the identity of the person who ordered Politkovskaya's killing remains unknown. The United States urges the Russian government to bring to justice those who ordered this crime. According to the latest State Department human rights report, there was no progress in establishing accountability in a number of other high-profile killings of journalists, including the 2004 killing of Paul Klebnikov in Moscow and the 2009 killing of Natalia Estyamirova in Chechnya. Additional journalists murdered in recent years in the North Caucasus include Timur Kwachyev, Akhmednabi Akhmednabiev, and Kazbek Gakiev. Russian journalists and bloggers who have uncovered various forms of government malfeasance continue to face harassment, either in the form of direct threats to their physical safety or threats to their security or livelihood, often through legal prosecution. By passing new repressive laws and selectively employing existing ones, the Russian government systematically harasses, discredits, prosecutes, imprisons, detains, and fines individuals and entities that engage in activities critical of the government. The Russian government has fined selected non-governmental institutions and stigmatized them by adding them to a list of registered foreign agents. Most recently, an appeals court upheld a $10,000 legal fine against Human Rights Center Memorial, one of Russia's best-known independent human rights groups. The arbitrary use and the abuse of the Russian legal system have created a climate of fear and self-censorship in Russia and put journalists and human rights defenders at risk. The United States supports the fundamental right of all Russians to free expression and assembly and calls on the Russian government to do the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.